Chapter 4, December 2nd, The Poisoner. Wiley leaped up from the computer, threw open the bottom drawer of the desk, grabbed the booze he kept there, and just plain poured it down. "Christ, you dummies! Can't you see it's a damn trick?" But they had not seen, not even Martin and Lindy. They'd gone to the church, too. They'd made themselves sitting damn ducks, and they'd... Oh, God. The poor Winters family and poor Harrow, all those good, decent people. Wanderers. It was worse than dying. But why was this being done to them, and where were they going? He thought that Martin was right about one thing. They were certainly on their way to designated locations. Collection points, though. He was just guessing about that. Maybe they were going to gas chambers or something. God forbid that such a fate would befall Lindy and Winnie. He was crazy about them, that sweet, bright little girl, her mother so full of love and brilliance. "This is not real," he said. "I refuse to let this be real." Maybe he wasn't recording events in the other human universe, but creating them. Maybe he was an instrument of the reptilians, and maybe that was why they had come into his life 5 years ago. They had done something to him, prepared him. But how? He knew that supple movement between parallel universes was involved with belief and the lack thereof. By continuing to deny that UFOs were something real, our own version of NASA had saved us, at least so far. But not him. Maybe not him. Thing was, the closer we got to December 21st, the easier it became to get through the gateways. And on that day, all hell was going to break loose in the other human universe. That had to be what this was all about, preparing for the invasion. And maybe here, too. No matter what our version of NASA denied or did not deny. He clicked through the pages he had written. He knew both more and less than what was in the laptop. For example, he knew what was happening in the Far East in Martin's world, which was a catastrophe so vast that it was, quite simply, unimaginable. He knew, but he couldn't access any detail, couldn't see much. Could feel it, though, the terror being experienced by billions. What would happen if everybody became a wanderer? He took a deep breath, let it out slowly. Damn Brooke and her rules. A cigar would go very, very well right now. Maybe Martin was right, and it was a harvest of slaves. Might not 6 billion slaves be worth something in the parallel earth of the reptilians? But if the souls were being taken out, then what was happening to them? Martin thought they were just disintegrating, but Wiley wasn't so sure of that. He had no idea what to think. He'd never really believed in the soul or God or any of that stuff. Like Martin, he'd been to Stanford and had come away also with a strong rationalism and fundamental disrespect for unprovable assertions. Those monstrous creatures wanted the bodies. He was convinced of it. Unless... How many parallel universes might there be? If the many-worlds interpretation of Hugh Everett was correct, then this oppression could be coming from any one of literally uncountable numbers of parallel universes. He thought not, though. He thought that the reptilian forms that the people in the church had glimpsed were the final telltale. He was right about the creatures, and he was right about their world. He could feel their need, could see their glaring, relentless eyes the same way he had on that night 5 years ago when they'd tried to... What had they tried to do? Had they really somehow captured him? No, something was wrong with that picture. He'd written a whole book about it, but he was increasingly aware of a missing element. Because what had happened to him on that night had been hard, but... There was just something missing. Tip of the tongue. Couldn't quite remember. Maybe it had something to do with the fact that there were three Earths involved. A triad. Buckminster Fuller had called the triangle the building block of the universe because of its structural integrity. There was a reason in conscious life also that notions of Trinity made structural sense. A triad had a positive side, a negative side, and a balancing side. If the two-moon Earth was the positive side, then the negative side was the reptilians with their evil hungers. Oh, Christ, he was not the balancing factor. I mean, well, let's face it, a middling writer with a burr up his ass about aliens is not the right guy to bring things into balance. In other words, not up to the job of... what? So far, he wasn't really doing a whole lot beyond writing a history that his world would take to be fiction. He wasn't helping anybody. He closed his eyes. If there was a God anywhere out there, may he now deliver his servant Wiley Dale from the curse of this writing. But even as he tried to push away the other human world, his mind slipped back toward its suffering. There, this house was now cold and dark, not nicely heated and cozy with a lovely family inside. As dawn broke here, the Phoebes started their sweet calling, the very essence of peace in the country. Over there, though, the people left alive were crying together, their sorrow unspeakable. Wiley was crying too, in silence, though. Brooke and the kids mustn't hear. Then Brooke was there. She had come quietly, and he had not heard her, but she was there, standing in the door of his office, and he thought she was an angel come down, and he turned to her in his creaky old chair and slid out of it and to his knees, and embraced her waist and buried his face in the sweet and sour scent of her. Her hands came around his head, and he felt cradled. She said, "You need to come to bed, love." "What time is it?" "The Phoebes are starting." He'd been in there for close to 24 hours. "Oh, man." "Wiley?" He looked up at her in her nightgown, so pale in the thin light that she might have been a ghost or a memory. "We're travelers on the long water," he muttered. "You and me, sweets. You and me." Her hand came into his, and it was warm, and he kissed it, and it smelled like sweat and remembrance. He went to his feet and took her into his arms, and she settled there. He closed his eyes and sailed in the comfort of her closeness. "You were crying," she said. "My story. It's really getting to you, Wiley." He nodded against her shoulder. "Your imagination is supposed to be a tool, not a weapon, especially not against yourself." "Oh, honey," he said. "Wiley, it's not real. Remember that this time. Don't get yourself confused." He nodded again. Her hands swept his thighs, then her long fingers probed at his pants. But playfully, quickly, he felt himself stir. She was his home, Brooke was, the home of his soul. She'd been there that night 5 years ago. It had been the two of them, and it... was it not what it seemed? "Let me show you a little reality," she whispered in his ear. "Let's do Dawn Patrol." That's what they called it when they made love in the early hours, which they often did. This is the time when children's sleep is deepest, and parents are least likely to be disturbed, and for Wiley when his body called him to the ocean of his wife. But as they walked arm in arm to the bedroom, he heard a door open and close downstairs, and then the voice, low and full of sorrow, of an invisible man. The man went into the living room and became silent there. "Did you hear that?"
"The warbler? He just started in."
"Not the warbler." She guided his hands to the familiar pink ribbon that was tied behind her neck, and he untied it, and the nightgown floated down. Her matchless curves shone in the rising light. Her nipples blushed pink and coming tight, and she was the loveliest thing that he knew, a beauty that, when it surrendered itself to his big hands and arms, seemed as if it must bear some sort of strength in it that was connected to eternity, or it would have melted into shadow at his touch. As she unbuckled his belt, she made a familiar tune in her throat. Never grow old, never grow old. A line from the old hymn that was a theme in the music of her life. And they would not in a love like the one that had possessed the two of them, and had possessed Martin and Lindy, too, and been destroyed just freshly, along with the children that had been woven out of its flesh. They lay with the windows open, their bodies close in the cool morning breeze, and came together while the birds called softly, the phoebes and the tanagers and the doves, and the first sun spread across the floor. When he should have been completely absorbed in her, when his body was radiant with pleasure, his eyes drinking her face, his powerful hips pumping and making her cry out softly, then, at that grand private moment, he heard another voice cry out, and knew that it was his own, and not his own, a broken, bereft voice from downstairs, and a universe so close and so very far away. He went plunging on, but then heard the back door slam, and the voice screaming, but faintly, faintly, and yet so terribly that it shattered everything and caused him to go twisting off her. He flopped onto his back, gasping. "Honey," she said. "Oh, honey," and came to him. But he leaped out of the bed. "It's him," he said. "Who?" Out in the backyard, he was screaming. Wiley ran downstairs. "Martin," he yelled. "Martin." He went through the living room and out the back door into the dewy grass. "Wiley, for God's sake." Then he heard them, their shuffling walk. The wanderers coming up from Harrow. He stood in a shaft of hazy light as they came closer and saw the branches shake, and then heard their voices murmuring, and heard Martin screaming and screaming. The murmuring came closer, got louder. "Hear it, Brooke?"
"What?"
They were right in front of him now, murmuring, breathing, their feet shuffling. "Brooke, look at the grass."
"Honey, oh, for God's sake."
The footprints came closer and closer. Then he reached out and he touched the air where one of them must be. He felt a shoulder, part of an arm. And then he saw them. Where he touched them, he could see a knit shirt, part of a neck, then a muscular forearm. "My God, look, look!" He reached, he touched the face and saw glazed, empty eyes, a slack mouth, male. But the man went on. The man did not seem to be aware of him at all. "Winnie!" he cried. "Lindy! Trevor!" Then he heard Martin. Heard him close. Heard him whispering, "Baby, baby, please, please wake up, baby." He reached out, and there, under his hand, was a khaki jacket, then a face. Martin. Richly alive, totally there. "Martin, Martin, you can't help them. You were all tricked. You should hide. You need to hide. Oh, Christ, somebody in the government is on the dark side, Martin. Can't you see that? They want this to happen." But Martin was gone. All around him, the wanderers continued passing, and he kept reaching out to them. He touched Mrs. Sweet from the drugstore, her gaping face, and the old pastor, Reginald Todd, and then Dr. Willerson, the town doctor, reduced to this. Oh, Jesus, Jesus. Then Brooke was there, and she slapped him so hard there was a flash and pain. He grabbed her wrist. "What the hell's the matter with you?"
"With me? You're naked in the backyard, for God's sake, and look, you have an audience."
There, face pale in his bedroom window, stood Nick, staring down on the scene. His expression was grave, like a judge at a sentencing. Wiley took the robe she'd brought and covered himself, and went in through the shuffling sounds of the wanderers, and Martin's cries, and the pleading, praying voices of the followers, and the last thing he heard was a child's voice calling for his mother and his father to stop, in the choked tones of a 12-year-old trying to be brave.
"Get in here, Wiley. You're scaring me."
She tugged at him, and he went with her. As they returned to the house, he waved up at his son. Inside, she threw her arms around him.
"Wiley, what is it? What's happening to you?"
"The story's got me. It's drowning me."
"Wiley, you were warned."
"I can't stop it."
"I want you to see Dr. Crutchfield. I want you to see him today."
"He's a wanderer."
"A what? What does that mean?"
"No, of course not. That's Dr. Willerson in the Two Moon world. I'm sorry. I'll call him."
"What in hell is a two-moon world?"
"A place of great beauty, my wife, that is being raped by creatures without mercy." He grabbed her shoulders. "And they are coming. They are coming here." She stepped back. She went pale. "In your heart," he said, "you know."
"I do not know."
Then Nick came downstairs. He looked up at them.
"I dreamed awful things," he said. "Then I woke up, and it was worse."
"What was your dream, son?"
"I dreamed we left, Dad. You tried, but you couldn't go where we were going, and we couldn't stop. And then I woke up, and you were in the yard. And what's wrong, Dad?"
Brooke gave Wiley a hard, hard look, and coming from his gentle Brooke, that meant a lot. It meant she thought he had hurt her boy. Then Kelsey came down, flitting along in her pink nighty, her curls bobbing. She looked just as darling as the most wonderful little girl picture ever taken, and he opened his arms and lifted her to him.
"I had a bad dream," she said. "I dreamed me and Mommy got leashes put on us, and we had to walk all night and forever, and I got so tired, but I couldn't stop. And you ran along behind us praying, and he had a bottle of Ayers water. I thought we didn't get bottled water. I thought it was too expensive."
"Now see," Brooke said, "that proves it was just a dream, because there's Evian and Perrier and Ozark and lots of other kinds of water, but there is no Ayers water."
"There isn't?"
"Not in this universe," Wiley told her and kissed her button nose. As best he could, he concealed what was almost a sickness of fear. In the other universe, they had Ayers water. He'd seen bottles among people's provisions in the church. But how had Kelsey known about it? How indeed? Unless the wall that separated the two human universes was already breaking down, just as he had feared it would, and hell was getting closer fast. They all went into the kitchen, and he turned on the radio, and he and Brooke made breakfast. His mind was completely focused on one thing. How had Kelsey known? What might be about to happen? "You're staring," she said. He shook his head. "Don't be mad at me."
"No."
"It's not even a big deal in physics. Parallel universes are real."
"I'm sure they are. I'm also sure that they don't cause people, just generally speaking, I mean, to leap around naked in their backyards. Your appointment with Crutchfield is at 8:30, so you'd better get rolling."
"8:30? You're kidding." She looked at him, and the fire in her eyes actually reassured him. He wanted to feel like somebody was in control, because he was not in control. He gobbled down the last of his eggs and went up to dress. Maybe this would actually be good. Maybe all that was happening here was that he was losing his grip, which, frankly, would be a hell of a lot better than what he feared. Moving fast, he managed to get to town just in time. As he drove along the familiar streets, he kept expecting to see little knots of tragic people, But all he did see was a small Kansas community in its mild prosperity, a gentle bustle in the streets, even a recent addition, the Starbucks. Nobody seemed strange. Nobody had a vacant look. He drove past Third Street Methodist. The church was closed, but it looked perfectly normal. Sylvester was on the walkway with a trowel, turning soil in a flower bed. Wiley slowed down and waved. "Hey there, Syl." Syl waved back. Nothing unusual. "Of course not, you fool. Things are fine in this universe. For now." When he arrived at Crutchfield's office, which was a walk-up above the Danforth Meat Market, one of the few small businesses hanging on in downtown, it was 8:40. "Sorry I'm late, Marla."
"Brooke says you've gone around the bend."
"That would be true."
"Then I'll remind you that I've got Mace."
He'd come on to the girl with the porcelain skin and the bright green eyes. But all in fun, of course. He would never cheat on Brooke. But with that black hair and that creamy skin, Marla did inspire. Crutchfield looked normal also. White hair, tiny glasses, a sense of therapeutic fog clinging to him.
"So, you were capering around in the backyard naked. Let's say we start there."
"Look, I've got... Oh, Christ. I've got something happening that I can't even begin to understand."
"I think Brooke is having exactly the same problem.
It feels to me as if something enormous is happening that has to do with what I'm writing, and it is not good, this huge thing, but I cannot stop writing about it even if I want to. I'm a sort of infernal machine."
"You're a machine?"
"Not in control of my own body. Not channeling, it's not like that. I sit there and I type. Automatic typing. I've abandoned my corona, and I'm just working on the computer. But the book isn't mine. I can write without thinking. Read, watch TV, close my eyes, it doesn't matter. My fingers just type away on their own."
"If your work isn't yours, whose would it be?"
"That's a hell of a good question. The answer is, I have no idea."
"But you're not involved in the writing?"
"Well, I am, of course, sort of, in the sense that I can see their world, hear their voices." "Shit. You moron. Moron!"
"I'm a moron?"
"I'm a moron. You don't tell a shrink you hear voices."
"The voices don't want you to tell me about them?"
"Ah, shit. Shit. God damn it. The voices don't care."
"So... what do they say?"
"They cry. They're suffering. Some of them came up through the yard, and when I touched them, I could see them, see the hands, the faces that I touched. Does that sound plain crazy or spectacularly crazy?"
"Sounds like I might as well get that new Lexus I've had my eye on."
"Do you know what a parallel universe is?"
"Something that exists deep inside the Kern Super Collider for a few billionths of a second."
"I'm not paying you to bait me, Henry. We're deducting 3 minutes of money for that little flippancy."
"You're afraid I'm laughing at you, but that isn't what's going on."
"What is?"
"I'm trying to make sense of what you're saying."
"Would it disturb you to know that in a parallel universe, a doctor very much like you, called Frank Willerson, is currently walking off toward the Northwest with most of the other people in this community, and he has no soul?"
"We're probably all better off without that soul mythology anyway. Let's you and me deal with who and what we know we are, which is us in this room together. Or are you here? Are you a projection from a parallel universe, Wiley? Is schizophrenia the problem here?"
"Look, I had a close encounter with creatures from a third parallel universe a few years ago, and because that happened, well, I'm doing what I'm doing."
"Which is?"
"I'd say I have no fucking idea, but I'm beginning to have an idea. I'm the balancing force between the positive and negative Earths.
Ah, of course. That makes complete sense. Would you be God, then, or just Jesus?
I'm Napoleon, you fuck.
Not interested, Wiley. Every psychiatrist reaches a point in his career where he has to draw a line. No more Napoleons. I reached that point a while back.
Am I insane?
Of course you're insane.
What can I do about it?
Come here a lot. Keep paying your bill.
You are a cynical man.
Yes, I am.
Look, I'll apologize to my wife for going out in the backyard naked, if that's a compromise here.
Is it a compromise?
When you're bored, you turn the patient's statements into questions. You're doing that now.
Henry lifted his arm, drew back his sleeve, and looked at his watch. I'm relieved to say that we've come to the end of our time, Wiley. You can reschedule with Marla.
Can I fuck her, too?
If you want to continue treatment with me, no.
You don't like me very much, do you?
Do you want me to like you?
He left the office without making another appointment. What was the point? The good doctor didn't believe a word he said. Hell, he didn't believe a word he said. Driving back in the Jeepazine, he made a decision. He would change it. He'd simply go back and alter the text. Because if he changed it, maybe he would also change events. No more ruined Winter's family, no more ruined world. He drove faster and faster still, thinking only of his computer, of the urgent need to return to his writing, which was returning to him, and fast, roaring into his head like some kind of a dam break flood blasting down the stream behind his house, a flood of words. And then there were lights, bright, back windshield. Damn, he did not need another ticket. He was going to need to take a damn compulsory driving course, which would take hours and piss him off in a mighty way. Hey there, Matt. I'm sorry. I guess I was a little fast there. Wiley, you were doing 111. Oh, that is bad. Well, you know, I don't usually stop town people, but... How's Becca?
Aw, shut up.
I could buy you a box of Partagas. Or just hand over the $1,500 they cost. Cash, now.
I'll take the money and smokes, but I'm still gonna have to write this up.
Aw, fuck, Matt. Damn it. Fuck!
Why were you going so fast? I mean, damn. What can I tell you? I'm crazy.
Matt wrote the ticket and handed it in for Wiley to sign.
This is gonna four-point you, but this is town. You're in town, and we just...
111 is not good, Wiley. I'm sorry. 4 points, added to the 80 already had, would mean not only compulsory driver's ed, but also a court appearance.
I'm gonna call George Piccolo and tell him you harassed me. You do that, and I'll beat your ass, boy.
When they were kids, Matt had always won. He was heavier, he was faster. But Wiley was capable of getting more pissed off, as he did now.
Give me the goddamn ticket, and for the love of God, don't tell Brooke or I'll get my ass whooped. Serious.
Well, you might like that.
Tell you what, I'm going to drive home at 30 miles an hour, and then I'm going back to the cave for a smoke. I'll call you on your cell to share my enjoyment with you.
Smoke my cigars, you're gonna eat the butts. Remember that, because I get off duty in an hour and I will check.
Hiding the ticket carefully, he drove on. He'd find a way to hide the fat check to the county in Quicken, somehow or other. Once back in his office, he pulled out the bottle of Woodford Reserve he kept in his bottom drawer liquor stash and sipped at it. What seemed like the next moment, voices caused him to come awake. Had he been sleeping? What had just happened? For a disoriented moment, he had the horrifying sense that he'd crossed into the parallel universe. But then the voices resolved into familiar ones. Brooke was coming in from the garage with the kids. She'd brought them home from school. He looked at his watch in stunned amazement. It was 4:30, and the sun was on its way down. He'd been sitting here all day.
Writing? He had no idea. He listened to Brooke, to Kelsey's high voice full of excitement about a snake in show and tell, to Nick's thumping tread on the back stairs. Then silence fell, and what he listened to now was the silence. Soon the words came again. The words. Whispering, shouting, demanding, from the other universe. It was Martin, and he was talking to himself, and Wiley knew why. The poor guy had stayed here at the house and was trying to force himself not to follow his family, and was agonized about that. Martin was crying out. Martin was more desperate than any human being Wiley had ever known. Chapter 5, December 3rd, The Bunker. And now, suddenly, Wiley was looking at trees, at grass. He knew that he was far from Harrow, Kansas. He wanted to return to Martin. He could feel the poor guy's mind just racing for solutions, could feel his hunger to give up and blow his poor damn brains out, and his agony that he could not, because those he loved could not. He took a deep breath, closed his eyes, and saw that he was in a dark meadow in a pine woods. There were vents low to the ground, humming softly. Two deer, their ears turning this way and that, ventured out from the shadows. Then he thought maybe he knew what this was. Martin had followed his family after all. He would have loaded his car up with food and water and set out through the woods and across the fields of his beloved Kansas, and that's where this was. But no, it was too quiet and too... well, the word was creepy. It had an evil feel to it, nasty. The deer were uneasy, flipping their tails, their great eyes wary. Night was falling here. The west was dense with clouds, and there was flickering in the clouds, a sign, he feared, of the disks. Then he wasn't in a meadow anymore. He was in a gray place that was softly rumbling. There were walls here, a long corridor lit by bulbs and wire cages. Footsteps came, somebody moving fast, and a man in uniform wheeled around a corner. General Al North moved along the hallway in what appeared to be a military bunker of some sort. As the general came closer, Wiley could see that his fatigues were dirty. His face was sheened with sweat. His eyes, which had been gray and full of resolve in Washington, were now the flitting eyes of a rat. So, he had survived the attack. Wiley had wondered about what had happened to these people. This was a huge thing, involving the whole world, and Washington had taken one of the early hits. Al burst into Tom Sampson's office. "Does the president know about this?" he shouted, throwing a crumpled sheet of paper down in his superior officer's desk. "How dare you! You're telling them to congregate? To gather in groups? Are you insane? God damn you!" "Oh, shut up with your bluster, Tom. You're in way over your head, and you never should have been appointed, and we both know it. But this isn't just executive ineptitude. This is treason, and I want an explanation that satisfies me, or I'm going to arrest you, General."
You don't have the authority."
"This is war. We're out of touch with higher authority.
The President of the United States is two offices away.
And I'm carrying, and you're not, and I'll shoot you as soon as look at you unless you explain this goddamn thing. How many people have received this?"
"Pitifully few, given that I'm forced to deliver it with blimps, trucks, Cessnas, and word of mouth."
"Let me go in another direction with this. We got a communication from Fort Riley about 3 hours ago to the effect that a group of small towns northwest of Topeka took a terrific hit last night. They had your pamphlet. They congregated in their churches, and 8 out of 10 of those people are now wanderers. Thank you, Tom. I thank you for them, for their families, for the country. And what's this Kansas deal? Why did you even leaflet these people?
Did you somehow know that Lautner County was going to take a hit?
Of course not.
Oh, no, you did, because you singled it out. 2 days ago, you directed a blimp run over the whole area.
Routine.
Really? Why not hit Topeka? Why not hit KC? But instead, you just go to this one little county. So, I have to ask you, Tom, whose side are you on?
Don't be ridiculous.
Our chains of command are busted all to hell, Tom. We're going down in damn flames worldwide. Bases raided by the disks time and again. Desertions by the tens of thousands. We're done, man.
We have a weapon.
What? Stealth bombers? Nukes like the one that failed to do jack shit to the Lens on Easter Island? Now there was a good move. We nuke 'em, and as a result, they pick up their pace 100-fold. So I'm not so sure I even want to hear about this damn weapon.
You want to hear about it?
He picked up the crumpled pamphlet. I want to hear about this, Tom.
Ah, Christ. Has anybody ever actually told you what an extreme asshole you are?
Please, Al said.
You talk about failure of discipline. Speaking of Kansas, you belong in Leavenworth.
Should Al just draw the gun and shoot? How would the president react to that? Tom, you should have told them to hide. Seal themselves in spaces where no light can reach. Force the attack to be executed in detail. Takes more time that way, and we already know that they withdraw at dawn.
Fish school, because mathematically the survival rate among large populations being attacked by predators is greater than that for isolated individuals. Same goes for herding animals. And under these circumstances, my friend, the same exact principle applies to us.
Let's put it to the president.
The pamphlets are being distributed as fast as we can manage it, and that's going to continue. Do you know why we were concerned about Lautner County?
No.
Your friend, the little man, the archaeologist, he's there, and they want him dead, I can assure you.
They? I'm dealing with lenses that emit these bursts of disks every night that go out and wreak havoc. There is no they.
Somebody's behind the lenses and behind the disks, never doubt it. And your man is a danger because he has the smarts and the knowledge of the deep past to maybe figure this out, and maybe, just maybe, to figure out a vulnerability. And they know it, and they are after that man.
Did they get him?
Don't know. The place is in chaos. Communications are down.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
You still ready to shoot me?
Al was silent.
Then you start respecting my command. You salute me and you call me sir.
Al shook his head, laughing to himself.
Do it now, goddamn you.
The two men glared at each other. Al did not salute.
I'm doing my job, Al, best I can, under the worst conditions any American general has ever experienced.
Slowly, as if his arm itself was unwilling, Al raised his hand and saluted.
Yes, sir, he said.
Okay, I have an appointment with the president. I want you in attendance, Al.
That surprised him so much he almost gagged. He'd seen himself as being on the way to Diego Garcia for a tour managing the fuel dump. As if there still was a Diego Garcia, let alone a base, let alone fuel. FaceTime with the president was a gift. Normally, he couldn't go on his own unless called, and Wade was not in the mood for squash, although there was a good court down here. He'd looked it over when they first came in, and this was all exciting and interesting, and they were going to nuke those suckers to glowing dust balls and go back home and triumph. As they went along the hall together, Tom put a hand on Al's shoulder.
We're not friends.
No.
But we need to put our personal battle on hold. We've got war fighting to do, and we are in trouble. You're about to hear a report that is going to disturb you, maybe also give you a ray of hope, but I want you to maintain strict military discipline in there. He will ask for your opinion, It will mirror mine.
Yes, sir. He realized that this was how it had to be. He just hoped to God that Tom was right. That business about congregating still sounded wrong. It sounded like intentional sabotage. They went through the outer office. No pretty furniture here. This place was constructed for work and work only. If the president was here, a catastrophe was unfolding. Communications equipment dominated. Secret Service agents with machine guns lined the halls, young men with stricken eyes, all watching the generals pass. Angry, bitter eyes. Mostly, the families of these people lived in places like Arlington and Bethesda, and those communities had been worked for a full week, all of them, and the fleeing lines of cars had been worked out on the interstates. Whoever was doing this knew exactly how to proceed. If you break the enemy's organization, you neutralize his war-fighting capacity even before he's aimed a weapon. Of course, down here, there was no question of the light being a threat, but this was obviously a special place. There were numerous corporate and private bunkers as well, he knew, not to mention government facilities all over the planet. But with all satellites fried and most land-based switching stations so loaded with atmospherics that they'd shut down, there was little communication except by messenger. And they could only run during daylight hours. They entered the presidential office, and Al was horrified at what he saw. The president looked like he'd lost 50 pounds. His eyes were dark, brooding shadows, trapped animal eyes. He looked mean, in the same way a struggling cur looks mean when you're trying to stuff it into a cage and be done with it. He raised his head, and at once the misery in the face was replaced by a beggar's grin. Now he was a used car salesman who'd spun his last lie.
"Sorry," he said, gesturing at papers on his desk. "Signing death warrants. Line of duty desertions, hundreds of them."
"You're ordering execution, sir?"
"Do me a favor, Al. Call me Jimmy." "You guys... should I, you think?"
"Yeah, it's total bullshit, isn't it? They came from CIA, not DOD. There is no DOD, of course, and Bo Waldo's gone. This shit's from staffers." He crumpled one up. "Kids like to kill."
"They're operating out of a unit in Maryland," Tom said. "Above ground, so it won't matter much longer, be my guess." "Jesus, what was that?"
The president looked up. They all looked up. There had been a sound coming out of the ceiling, a low noise, loud enough, though, to drown conversation.
"Call the contractor," the president said, acid in his voice. "Try flushing my toilet sometime. You want a hell of a damn surprise." He sighed.
"I wish I knew where my wife and kids were. Do you fellas know where your families are?"
"I've been divorced, Jimmy. Oh, long time," Al said.
Sissy had packed it in when they were still base bums, shuffling around the world. He'd never bothered to remarry. The Air Force was his wife, his kids, his mistress, all that and more. As far as his rocks were concerned, he got them off the way monks did.
"My wife is whereabouts unknown," Tom said.
They'd worked together a long time for Al not to know that Tom was married, but it had never come up. Come to think of it, they'd never even shared a round of golf together, or a game of squash, or had a drink. Then again, maybe Tom didn't drink. Addicts don't, do they? The sound came again, and this time it was in the wall, moving down from above. The president stood up. "Is that normal?"
"It's the plumbing," Tom said. "What we need to talk about is, I want to reach out to this man, Martin Winters. I want to reach out to other people with knowledge of the deep past. I have a list. Graham Hancock, William Henry, Lawrence Gardner, John Jenkins, all leading experts who used to be considered wrong. I want them all located."
The president went to the wall, felt it. "There's heat," he said. That should not be.
Call security, Al said.
Tom gave him a look that said he had just overstepped his bounds. Don't speak unless spoken to.
I have come to believe that what's happening has to do with the deep past, Tom continued.
That's not news, the president snapped. Tell me something I can use, please. And don't ask me for permission to convene meetings. I don't care who the hell you talk to. Just save our asses here, Tom. For God's sake, Homeland Security, what's left of it, tells me we're losing 500,000 people a night just in this country. Wanderers. Well, they aren't wandering. They're all heading to 3 points, northern Nevada, central Nebraska, and northern Indiana. Now why? You might ask, right, Al?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. The FBI is in total meltdown, so that leaves military intelligence. So here's my question to you fellas. Do you have any assets working?
We've got assets, Al said.
Oh, good. Then reach out and get me reports. He laughed a little. The beaten dog look returned. Beaten dog turned mean.
Or just tell them to fucking nuke themselves. I mean, why wait around? Wandering's hard in the Tootsies, I hear.
He took a fabulous silver-clad .45 automatic out of a desk drawer, laid it on the desk. Can you guys imagine what it is like to be a pregnant woman now, out there? He sucked air through bared teeth. His color had deepened so much that Al thought he might be having a coronary. My God. But it was also very, very beautiful. And how odd that we didn't know it. All that yelling, all that scheming, the money, my dear heaven, the money. And what was it in the end? I have come to this. A single child seeing one single leaf that is turned in the fine autumn air means more than all of that. A child clapping because the leaf is red, and it was green.
Mr. President.
Of course I've gone mad, Tom. For God's sake, in this situation, madness is sanity. Millie, where are you, baby? Are you out there walking in the dark path with all the others? Oh, Millie. 44 years she walked beside me, fellas. 44 years. She gave it all. Everything she had to give. And I can't even think about Mark. Somewhere, I trust.
My poor boy. He picked up the gun. Gentlemen, would you like to join me in a bite of bullet?
Mr. President!
Al, you know what? You are the nicest man I have ever known. He laughed.
That's why I gave Shitheel here your job. He can do it. He's a real bastard. I'm sorry, Al, but you came along at the burnt-out end of the age. No more room for good men. He sighed. What rough beast slouches toward Bethlehem? I had a great uncle who knew Yeats. Met him by simply going up to his door in Dublin and knocking. Oh, my God, the voice of the man, the voice of Yeats. He wept, and Al almost wept with him. There came then a sort of chuckling sound. It was really a very strange sound, so strange that Al knew at once that it was no noise ever heard on this earth before, at least not in this cycle of history. The president's head snapped to the left. He stared at the wall. Then he turned back, his eyes liquid with pleading. Why? He was pleading with Tom. But Tom didn't need to be pleaded with. He was an underling. Something then happened that must have looked to Al like the arrival of the Spaniards on their horses must have looked to the Aztecs. Something was in the room that could not be there, that had come from nowhere, not out of the wall, but out of the sound in the wall. He could not say exactly what it looked like, a shell so black that it absorbed light, or a machine propelled on enormous legs, or a gigantic spider, even. The sort of thing that comes out of the closet when you are 4 and eventually recedes on the expiring tide of childhood. He heard a voice. Agnus Dei.
Lamb of God, sounding so pure that it was as if sounded from the highest, the farthest of all voices, a voice beyond telling, weighed, ascending.
Qui tollis peccata mundi,
the president whispered. Who takes away the sins of the world? The roar of the gun was like a blast of Satan's breath, so ferocious that it made Al cry out, so enormous that it seemed to gather the whole bunker in its strength and crush it to rubble. Al had him in his arms before his body, which had slapped into the wall, had even begun to slide to the floor. He stank of raw blood. His left eye was shuddering like the wing of a wounded fly, then green and bloody vomit pumped out of him with a furious, questing seizure that parodied sexual passion. Secret Service poured into the room. One of them lifted his machine gun, braced it at Tom, who stood quite calmly, the very least of smiles on his face. He did not even glance at the young man with the gun, or any of the young men frozen in the doorway.
"I have a mission for you, Al," he said. "Put him down. You'll need to leave at once."
Al laid the president, Jimmy, on the thinly carpeted floor. He went to attention.
"Yes, sir," he said.
He saluted his superior officer, now the leader of the free world.